Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and this is the first show we're recording in 2022. And
yes.
And my co-host and my mother is with me today, down the road a bit. We're both holed out in our minus below zero temperature homes. Well, our homes are nice and warm. Hi, Mom. Hi, Caroline.
Hi. Oh, yeah. It's cold out, but thank God I have a nice warm home.
Yeah. So we have a guest today who I believe was with us once quite a few years ago and whose authors have been with us a number of times. Steve Semkin is the driving force behind the Ice Cube Press and Tall Corn Books imprint. And Steve has been inspired to work with words, to write, and to promote and learn about the world in which we live in for over 25 years now. And the inspiration began while walking and living along the Kaw River in North Lawrence, Kansas. So maybe Steve will tell us a little more about that. Since 1990, Steve has authored 6 books, edited 3 others, been included in 4 anthologies, and was picked as the writer in residence at the Island Institute in Alaska. He has served on the faculty at the Midwest Writing Center's David Collins Writing Conference in the Quad Cities, and for over 10 years sponsored and organized the annual Harvard Lecture Voices from the Prairie, which had a number of homes during that time. And he works full-time as a publisher with Ice Cube Press. Welcome back to Writer's Voices, Steve.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here. I feel like every once in a while I can drop in.
Yeah.
I'm not really that individually interesting. It's all the books that everybody writes that are kind of interesting. But I'm trying to do – I've sort of forced myself to –
to push your personal brand
because it's like this year is like 30 years, so I was like, everyone's like, do something.
30 like, okay. Years with Ice Cube Press.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
You can tell how often I update my webpage now.
Wow.
Every 5 years. I started in 1991.
Wow.
So I thought, well, you know, why not? I was going to be last year. And then I was thinking, I'll have this big party. And then, like, all of us were like, no, we're not going to do those for a while.
Yeah.
So now I'm, like, getting around to it.
And who knows if we'll get to do it this year in terms of the big party.
Exactly. I was all like, I can hardly wait till things are normal. I'm like, I can't even believe I'm wishing for normal because I don't even remember that being that amazing. But I'd go back to that now.
Yeah. It's been, you know, I think about the kids – for whom this has now become normal.
I know. It's true. My daughter nannies these 2 kids, and they're in preschool and kindergarten. And as far as they know, you just wear a mask to school. Like they've never known anything
know.
Other than that their entire lives.
My grandkids are 9 and 12, and they don't have any issue with wearing a mask. It doesn't bother
right.
them. But they both stayed home until this year. So they spent a year
right.
and a half at home.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
it did cause some hardship.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I bet on everybody. Right?
Mm-hmm,
it's like, where's the other kids? Why are the kids still here?
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It's like you can care about people a lot, but it's like you do need breaks from things. Even if it's not like, I mean, I don't mean in a bad way. It's just like it's an ever.
Yeah.
I mean, it probably
yeah.
feels like.
Yeah.
I mean, all of us, we're parents, are like, I kind of am looking forward to them going to school for a little while.
Yeah, and also for the kids, learning online was harder. I think
mm-hmm.
they did not get caught up. And my
right.
Their mother is a teacher, and she said in Texas, and they're expecting the kids to perform at the same level as they did before all this, and they can't because they're
right.
behind. And
it's also like the teachers didn't know. I mean, not that everyone's doing their best, but there's no way to expect a teacher that's been in front of kids for their whole life to suddenly be the most perfect online teacher
yes,
either. So it's
exactly.
like both sides are really frustrating.
Right. And a lot of the teachers were trying to do both at the same time, which is even
yeah.
harder. And
yeah.
even when they were in the classroom, they weren't allowed to get near the kids that were there.
Right.
And so they mm-hmm. were basically doing remote in person. The kids all had their tablets and yeah, it's anyway, horrifying. Yeah, right. It's a tough world. But Steve, tell us why you decided to start publishing books. I know you've told this story before, but we'd like to hear it again.
Hey, I come up with a new story every time you know about it. Someday someone's going to go back and go, there's as many variety versions of why he started as there are interviews, which might be true. I'm not sure if I tell it the same way. But you had mentioned the thing I like about this show is I can just take my time, right?
Right. Yes. Yes.
Well, I mean, in 1991, I theoretically began, but I would say I started way before that as far as like I was interested in writing. And I don't have a master's in or an MFA in writing or a business or editing or words or any sort of computer programs, but I just knew I wanted to be involved in writing, and it all kind of was going slowly because I was a customer service rep at the cable company, and I was like, how is this going to eventually become me being involved in writing in one way or another? And I just, and that's what started the press, is that I was like, okay, I know I could probably come up with something. I'd started with a newsletter called Sycamore Roots, New Native Americans, and that was 1991. And that's when I had Sycamore Roots, New Native Americans, Ice Cube Press. The actual name of the press, which that was me just, I had written a short story and I had this guy and he kept seeing mirages, and then he thought, and in our minds we always think, wouldn't it be great if we ever, because when I drive I'm like, maybe I'm going to get that mirage this time on the road. But this time it actually happened. This guy was wandering the kind of the plains and made it into the mirage, and on the inside was the Ice Cube Cafe. And the reason why that just lasted, and I think the thing to that is not necessarily unique to me, but like I had started like a new idea for a business every week or every couple months back then. Like I was going to be a VW mechanic, so I did that. And then I was going to be a timber framer, and then I was going to be, and I had different jobs all the time. And so when I called it the Ice Cube Press, that's how I came up with the name for it. But I didn't put any thought into it. I mean, in my mind, there was no reason for me to believe the day that I sent that first newsletter out that it would be around for more than a couple months. I mean, I had no precedent for that. I was bouncing all around trying new things. And so the fact that this has lasted is sort of miraculous for who I am. But at some point, I mean, it went a couple of years, and I did the first book, and then I did another book, and then I let the Sycamore Roots Journal go to the side. And at some point you realize, well, it may not be the best name ever for anything, but it's the one that I've already invested some time into, and I don't have to start exactly over. I mean, if I called someone, they'd be like, well, I've at least heard of you. And so, you know, it probably should have been like Better Books Incorporated or AAA Books, or I mean, who knows? But I mean, it's not like super business savvy name, I suppose. But I mean,
well, in a way it is, because it's memorable. Right. It's right. Unique. You know, it's something that, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I guess you don't forget it. And a lot of people have told me, they're like, I know why you came up with the name. And this is the one that always sticks with me. They're always like, somebody was saying, I know, I'm so glad you did that, because like when water freezes, it turns into ice. And so things transform. And I was like, yep, that's why I named it that. So that's actually a pretty decent name, right?
It is. Now, as you told the story about it, though, I thought maybe the punchline was going to be that you named it that because you expected it to melt away shortly.
Well, I should have thought that. I mean, I think that's kind of the biggest surprise in all of it. It's just like, I don't know why this one thing stuck. And I think it's just because I care about it more than the other things. Who knows? I'm not really sure.
Well, it sounds like the other things didn't have a whole lot to do with writing.
No, not really. I mean, I will envision myself being, you know, this some high apartment building in a big city, typing away on my manual typewriter. I mean, I thought like that. I didn't really lose that idea. up until maybe 10 years ago, which is a little embarrassing, but I mean, I kind of held on to this, like, oh, I'm still going to make it. I'm still going to write this, this really best-selling book. And I mean, I still, of course, secretly think that someday I might.
Yeah, why not?
But, I mean, the reality of it is that I really thought it would happen. And now I'm like, okay, that might happen.
Okay.
Like, I mean, I don't know. In the back of my mind, I was like, that could still happen. And now, having been in writing and publishing for a while, I'm not even sure if I want that to happen. I mean, there's certain parts, like when people are like, it must be so, like, the idea of coming out with a new book to me as a book publisher is not nearly as endearing as it is to a first-time author. I can tell you that much. And it's not that it's not fun, but I kind of like, oh man, that's a lot of work.
Yeah,
to bring a book into the world and be the writer. I mean, I know what it's like on my side, and I know what it's like having written some books, but anyway, that's probably one of your questions.
So do you like being on the publisher side more?
Oh yeah. That question has got lots of sides to it. It's always like, because a lot of people don't know me. They think that my lifelong passion is to have been a writer, and it was, but there's something about, being a book publisher for other authors that has sort of brought out, I think it's a skill that I have that I feel is valuable. I don't know if you had a year left to live, will you regret not having written another book? And I would say yes, but I also won't look back and say, oh my God, you wasted 30 plus years helping other people be writers. That I would never think that. I think that it's probably one of the most exciting things that I've ever done is take ideas that come into me out of the blue and give people like sort of their goal or their dream come true. I mean, it took me a long time to realize that that when people send me submissions or they come up with a book, that it's really important to them. Like, I mean, people write, they spend like extra time in their lives to come up with their book ideas. Like, they could be going out and doing other things, but instead most of the books I get are like, other than their health and their family and their kids, like the book they wrote is a huge deal to them. And then they turn around and they give it to me and hope that I'll accept it. And if I do, I've like really made something come true for them. And so I think it took me a long time to realize that. And I'm not going to say that I treat every submission with the utmost care that it deserves. But if I did, that's probably all I'd be doing the rest of my life. Some of it is, you know, that's why publishers have guidelines on what they're interested in, because it's like, I realize that some things are important to other people, but I can't always help them with those. But the concept of the time and energy and passion that a person puts into writing a book, I don't disregard that at all anymore.
Well, when you're writing, does then the publishing work, do you feel like it's pulling you away from your book? And is there a tension there between those two sides of your life?
Well, probably. It's more because people keep asking me that question. I mean, no, I have things like sometimes, you know, like a lot of us were like, man, I wish I had someone that could live the other two ideas or the other three lives that I'd like to be trying out. And it's like, just report back to me how it went. And so, clearly, I mean, publishing has allowed me a chance to be involved with writing, make money, even though I don't encourage anyone else to do it, mostly because then I'll be one of the only people doing it. So there's not that much competition, which isn't totally true. I wouldn't agree with that comment that I just made. But I mean, I have managed to figure out a way to survive doing it. And at this point, I don't know what else I would do. But there is a tension there. I mean, I don't know. I don't think if I stopped publishing, I'd spend all my time writing. I don't think that's how it works. So I don't know. I kind of have myself on this slow. Like I literally hadn't thought about writing another book for the last 7 or 8 years. And doing these 30-year interviews like this or questions has reminded me that I do have some things I would like to try, but I'm not in a super hurry to step on the gas and be like, I have this book on. I mean, my 21-year-old daughter is like, Dad, remember that book you did on monsters when I was a little kid? I'm like, yes. She's like, when are you going to finish that? I'm like, you're right. I mean, in her life, it doesn't seem like that long to me. But I mean, from the age that she was just sitting around wondering what I was doing to now being almost graduating in college, in her life, she's like, what is taking you so long?
So a book on monsters. Tell me a little bit more about this.
I was reading like those bestiaries and some of the stories about animals that sort of these fictional animals, but there's a whole collection of folklore on animals that either once existed or could exist and we can't say. I'm not like a Bigfoot or something, which I'm not saying that's not real, but because there's some tracks in the snow out here today. I don't know. I just started doing drawings on like sort of like creatures that would be in like the old bestiaries of and I started calling it like my most believable animals or my most believable stories of just like there's birds that would lay square eggs and then they would live on steep cliffs because otherwise all their eggs would roll off the cliffs. Or there's creatures that they don't have a face unless their heads are turned at the angle and then something appears. Or I don't know. I started getting captivated by that. So I have like 300 or 400 of these drawings.
Oh my.
And like introductory paragraphs. Now I'm like, ugh. But every time I look at it, I think, man, that's going to take me forever. So clearly I have to choose my favorite 100 or something, but like I'd like to see that through at some point.
Sounds cool.
Pretty cool. But I think also part of the thrill is just that it's there, because that's the funny thing about writing or publishing. I mean, books are hard to do. And I think like I'm working with a guy writing a book on land, Neil Hamilton out of Des Moines, and I mean, his book is in great shape, but he realized when I started writing this, I didn't think it would be that hard. But you know what? It's really hard. I said, it's not easy to get every period right and every word spelled correctly and every paragraph break. I mean, there's a ton of details all along the way. And if you're not, and if someone tells me, I remember someone said, I've already read this over and changed it 3 times. And I was like, yeah, I haven't even started. I still have like 47 more versions to go. It's a long time because when other people read rough drafts, what you assume is correct isn't always the way other people read it. And so if your point is to be a writer, then you're writing for other people, not really yourself. And so then you're obligated to turn it into something that is for readers, not for, I guess that's maybe the difference between journaling and writing.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how you ended up where you are in this small place in Iowa.
Well, I grew up in Iowa City. And I mean, as far as I know, I did. I mean, we moved. My family started in Michigan and we moved here when I was maybe 2 and a half. And I could probably get, you know, some hypnotism and figure out those early years, but I haven't done that yet. But anyway, I grew up here and like almost anybody between high school and college, I was like, I'm leaving. I'm going to go find a much better world. And so I ended up in Kansas and Oregon and Idaho and Michigan. See, this goes with my track record of how in the world did this particular press last for 30 years? Because I was really jumping around. And then I got married and lived in Lawrence. And we were there for about 6 years and then we moved to Oregon, and then I don't know why I just decided that, hey, let's just go to Iowa City again, or Iowa City area. And that happened in 96, and everything's kind of just cruising along. I mean, you can find what you want anywhere at this point, I think, some way. And so it's just a...
Well, do you feel like, Iowa City is known as a writer's community. Do you feel any support from that, or...
Not really. I mean, I get that it's the city of literature and the writer's workshop is there, and it's not really, no matter how I answer this question, it's gonna feel like I'm picking sides or disparaging one side, but it's not really, other than the fact that there's one bookstore here, Prairie Lights, and there's writers in town. That's about as far as the things go, really. Mm. I mean, I'm not really involved in that part of learning how to write. And I did a book by a guy from the University of Iowa workshop, and I'm working on another one with someone. And like Mary Swander, I think, went to the workshop or was associated with it. But it doesn't really involve my life. But on the other hand, I answer that question 100% differently. I'm one of the board members for the City of Literature. And I sometimes think to myself, well, if I grew up in Iowa City and I went to the University of Iowa and I'm a book publisher and I'm on the City of Literature in some ways, I'm sort of like the quintessential City of Literature child, right?
Right.
Not really. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find someone that kind of went through the Iowa City schools and then went to the University of Iowa and then became a book publisher in the City of Literature. So, I mean, I guess my other answer to that question is it's the perfect place for me. And so on one hand, yeah, I'm totally involved. I know when they first applied to get the City of Literature status, unbeknownst to me, they used my press as one of the applications, one of the reasons why they should be granted that status. And it wasn't until years later when there was an internet search and I saw that, and I looked in and I was like, well, that's kind of strange that they included me in that without telling me. But on the other hand, I'm like, I'm glad I could be of service to your application.
And then don't they have an annual book festival too?
Yeah, they do. There's the Iowa City Book Festival, and I might as well be coming in from anywhere, because I get my car loaded up and go, set up a booth, and the authors will speak there, and so it's useful. But then again, I also go to the St. Paul Book Show, and I go to the regional shows, so it helps that I know people at that one. But so it's kind of hard for me to answer that question, because I think it's the perfect place for all sorts of reasons. I mean, people are open to, I could be in Fairfield and I think people would be excited to have a publisher.
Oh, definitely.
I think almost anywhere in some strange way, there's the image of what the publisher is. And then there's also the reality of what it is. And I don't really need anyone to know the reality of it, because that's like, I don't need to know the reality of really any job, right? I just need to know what happens once you do it.
Well, how has independent publishing changed in the 30 years you've been doing it?
Well, it's almost what hasn't changed. I mean, thankfully, the one thing that hasn't changed for me is the production and creation of tangible objects. But there's times when you feel like that might not be part of it anymore. there's fewer stores, and the spirit of independent anything, despite the fact that we keep having Small Business Saturdays, which, by the way, are brought to us by American Express. So if anyone pauses for a second and thinks about that, they're like, it's not Small Business Saturday. It's gigantic credit card company service service charge day. I mean, I just think that that, I mean, that sort of typifies the way it is, because there, I feel like there's fewer honest to God in, I mean, I guess maybe it's my my idea of what independent is, but my idea of independent, especially for bookstores, I mean, when I started, there was 21st Century Books in Fairfield, and there was also, I think that was the main independent in town when I very first started. And there was a guy in town named John Kramer who went on and started this huge thing called book marketing.
Right.
And I remember meeting him right before he moved to New Mexico. But I think that, like, I used to go to books. I still like bookstores, but I used to go and I felt like I was getting sort of the personality of the store. And they're sort of, it was browsing was sort of an exciting thing to do, because you'd go in, and now, and I don't want to sound like this really crotchety old guy, but I mean, I know, because I work with independent booksellers still, is that it doesn't feel like they have a personality as much as they did. I think it's more of I feel like it's become almost survival, like they need to have the New York Times bestsellers. And they don't have as much of the store reflecting sort of what they're passionate about, which I think then is a catch-22, because if you focus on what makes your store unique, maybe that's a way not to keep your store in business. I really don't know. I mean, and a lot of it is just, I think that it's harder to be a small business of any sort.
Yeah.
And I think that has affected almost anything. And the sad part is that I don't think there's ever been a time when people have the chance and the ability to express themselves more. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, the value of a book has probably never been bigger. But it's just hard. And like most bookstores use, even if they're like, we're a small independent mom and pop bookstore, I'm like, it is, but you're not. Like, you're still using a huge $1 billion distributor in order to stock the books at your store. I mean, like, people are using Amazon, but honestly, a lot of the bookstores are using Amazon imitators in order to stock their books and have them shipped to them. I mean, they're not ordered. They're not. A majority of them aren't calling me and ordering small individual packets of books. And so it's like, there's just a lot of, it's not as, I don't know that it was ever luxury, like an easy way to make money, but it's harder and harder as time goes by. And all of us that want to stay in business have to get a little hardened to that and raise our prices or find, like, I really push people buying books directly off my webpage now. Because this became me answering the question in a weird way. Because what I wanted to say in the very beginning is that when I first started, some of the changes were, I don't want to turn it into a business show. I'll be talking about the hardships of earning money. But like when I started, I didn't have an email and I didn't have a web page. And I used to scurry over to the Lawrence Public Library and get the Literary Marketplace book out. Gosh, it has the name of every bookstore in there and who owns it. And then I remember in 1995, I was at work and I listed my first book on this thing called Amazon and it was all new. I was like, man, I'm going to try this out. This seems really ridiculous. And I signed that first book up for two or three online book pages to sell books that day. And who knew that Amazon would become like of something. But yeah, it's just like, and so that kind of is how far back it goes. And I'm not even it's not like I'm super ancient or anything, but within the 30 years that I've been doing it, those are like huge changes when you think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I just writing letters and calling people on the phone and checking in once a week on the phone. Just like, hey, did you get the sample I sent you? Or, and now that would probably be a pretty good technique again.
Because nobody's like, doing it.
Right. Sometimes you want to tell people, like, I have this invention. And you can actually dial these numbers and talk to people in person. It's called a phone. I'm holding one right now. So everyone's like, text, email, this, that, that.
Yeah.
No, there's a really simple way to get to it.
Yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Steve Semkin, author and publisher, owner of the Ice Cube Press. And what is the Tall Corn?
I know, that's how I knew you were reading one of the old Bibles, which isn't your fault. I should have seen the new one. But, well, it still exists. A lot of the times you break, like a publisher, like you two read a lot. So, like Harper's has divisions of books within it, and they call those imprints.
Right, right.
And I think you've interviewed Zach Jack before, Zachary Jack. And his books are kind of typical of what a Tall Corn book would be. And I haven't done one in a while, but it was going to be. It was just books that were more specific. And so something about growing up or living in Iowa with like straight Iowa ties.
Okay.
And so I have one called Maintenance Inn Press or Maintenance Inn Imprint. And that was going to be kind of, and we've done one and we're planning a second one, but kind of where, you know, you see those signs like low maintenance road ahead. It's like where sort of civilized society takes and stops. You're sort of on your own. And so Maintenance Ends is another imprint.
Maintenance Ends. Okay. Gotcha.
So
gotcha.
There's sort of like, and what for me has been the case is there was someone that sort of volunteered or wanted to start their own idea. So you'll have series editors for some things like University of Iowa Press has the Baroque books. And I think that's a separate person choosing the books that go within that. And so that's what it's been for me, is someone's come along and said, I'd really like to help. And these are some of my ideas. And then I say, fine, you can have, we'll start a thing called your like Tall Corn books or Maintenance Ends, that sort of thing.
So Steve, how many books have you published in this 30 years?
A lot. I mean, I know that I'm closing in on a couple hundred because I buy these ISBN sheets by the hundreds, and I'm about to apply for the third one, which means I must be going on to book 301.
Wow.
Or 102, yeah, 301
and
at some point soon.
Are they all still in print?
Do
you have them all listed on your website? Can someone go in?
They're not.
Nope.
They're not all on my webpage, and that's more just me not knowing how to do webpages. I mean – over time, they've all been listed. They're probably close to all of them might be on Amazon. I'm not sure. But you really don't need to let a book go out of print anymore, even though there are some. Like I did a book called Women in the Land, which was a big color photo book.
I remember that one.
Okay.
Yes.
And that one is actually out of print, which is very unusual for me because I never want anything to go out of print as long as I'm alive. And it's easier these days because you can print smaller numbers, but like that one just has to be done on an offset printer. Otherwise it's just absurdly expensive, unless someone wants to pay me $1,000 for a copy. But for the most part, they're all online. And if I had the chance, I could list a ton of them on my website, but I just, you know, I just can't keep up with all that stuff.
I'm looking through though and seeing how many we've interviewed a lot of your authors. Mm-hmm. I'm
trying to do them all.
Yeah.
Well, not every one have I ever, but if I think they would be interesting, I do. Everyone's interesting, but some of them are kind of far fetched, I think.
Yeah. What makes you? I'm looking at one actually I didn't see before, called The House of Moffat. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm looking at that is because that is your mother's maiden name, Moffat. Now, yeah. How was it spelled, Mom?
M-O-F-F-I-T-T.
That's the same.
Are you related to the family that did the Moffat houses, the stone houses in Iowa City?
Well,
I don't think so.
I wonder, probably, because that's not that common a – and this, I mean,
right.
The Moffitts, they were in Iowa. They were in Jasper County, Iowa, the Moffitts.
Oh, you know about them, yeah.
Yeah, so,
well,
I mean, our Moffitts. So I had never heard of this Moffat,
right.
This House of Moffat.
Well, there's all these – I'll send you a copy. And that – see, you can't interview him because he just passed away.
Oh.
Oh.
But he was a doctor at the university. But his family grew up in these, and there were these, the cover photo is not really representative of what people think of as Moffett houses, but they were this guy named Charles Moffett, I'm going to get my years wrong, but in the 1900s, how about that? Before 1950, he was putting together affordable housing. And so this guy was like, it was kind of ahead of his time because he was using limestones and any materials he could find to put together houses. And they always looked, they kind of developed a style of limestone houses, not super big, but, and I guess when you take them apart, if the window's around, you'll find an old wheel, on the metal part of the wheel as kind of the frame for the window. And you'll find old newspapers and signs and stuff used to hold up the walls. But it's very authentic housing. As far as I know, it was an Iowa City thing. And they moved to Texas, that family. So I don't know if that's in the Jesper family history or not. But I mean, that book had come to me, and he had been always fascinated by the house and who the person was and how many people had lived in those kind of houses. And that sounded just like the kind of book for me. I just thought you kind of explore a little bit deeper into something that you take for granted or somebody's really passionate about, a particular detail that other people can relate to.
Well, we have the whole Moffett genealogy, so we'll have to look and see if we can find if we're related to the House of Moffett in Iowa City.
I hope you are.
Yeah.
We'll add that much more to your life.
Wow.
Yeah. It might be on Ancestry.com. There'll be a photo on there.
Yeah. So, Steve, what you know, you say you have like guidelines of what kind of submissions that you accept. What are you looking for?
Well, that's also, of course, an unfair question to ask me because, I mean, it's not fair to tell people I'm looking for one particular thing. If you look through the things I've done, like there's one called Holding My Hand Through Hell, I think. There's no reason under the sun I should ever have picked that book. There's really no reason why I picked – there's one I just did recently, and it doesn't match what you'd think I'd be interested in. But I sort of like to say – I know Greg Brown started Red House Records, which is in Minneapolis now, I think. But someone had asked him, as a person that started a record label, like, what did he look for? And he said – and I remember his answer was along the lines of, well, I'm interested in what I like. And I trust that. And so I realized that that's true. Like what I mentioned, what I publish are things that get my attention, that I like. And then the biggest leap of faith that I think separates, I almost hate to say this without like 16 old growth wooden things to knock on, but is that you do just have to trust that what you're curious about and interested in is what other people will learn to believe that you're not, that they trust your opinions also. I mean, and so it happens that most of the time I like things that have to do with the environment and things that have to do with where like Midwestern themes, but not always. Like I took a poetry book on, I think it's called Postmodern Blues and You May or May Not Love Me. And there's really no themes in there that have a standing in what I've done over the years. But on the other hand, I found them like very insightful and honest and well told. And I just couldn't say no. And I learn a lot from reading people's books. I mean, I'm sort of this closeted, naive person that gets books sent to me. I'm like, is that true? Like, I mean, I'm going to have to read about that. And I'll ask like the dumbest. And so I'm some ways I'm the perfect reader because I'm not an idiot. But so I'll ask them questions like, are you sure? Or what? How? and I'll learn about it as I'm reading these people's books. But I don't really, I guess that it's not, I don't have a set answer on what I look for.
I mean, so, but you, but, and, but you publish poetry, you publish graphic novels, you publish memoir, you publish a lot of nonfiction. You've published some thrillers.
Yeah, I have a graphic novel. I mean, I thought The Moon of the Snowblind is, that was my first graphic novel, and that was in March of last year. And that, there's so many things about, like, I didn't know that I would, I don't mind graphic novels. I'd never really worked with one before. But Gary Kelly had been aiming for me for a while, and not in a bad way. I knew some of his friends, and he kept saying, I'm going to do a graphic novel someday on the Spirit Lake incident up there in Northeast Iowa. And I said, sounds great. And that took like 4 or 5 years to come about. And when you read it, it is like kind of the perfect book for me, because it explores something that happened in Iowa that at the same time has implications for any place, and certainly the Midwest. I mean, it's strange how I've been pigeonholed by the publishing and book industry into the Iowa publisher, which I am, but the topics don't like stop at the state line or something.
No.
It's one of those things you just have to keep, like, it's not about that. Like, you rarely see me, you'll rarely see a book description of mine that on the back cover that just uses the word Iowa ever at this point. I'm always like Midwestern, Central States, anything. I don't need anyone to do that. But then Gary, I have another one coming out in May this year, another graphic novel of his called Bach and the Blues, which is a graphic novel on the cello player Pablo Casals and the blues musician Robert Johnson. And so this is the leap where everyone would go, why would you be doing that one? But that's because I find it really fascinating that this cello player in Europe and Robert Johnson in the South United States were both dealing with the same issues of revolution and racism. And I mean, there's a Spanish Revolution and the rise of Germany in Casals' time, and then Robert Johnson was dealing with all the inequality of the South. And then on one week in November in the same year, they both ended up recording their greatest albums. And so it's a fascinating, like, graphic novel of these two with all their similarities. And so on the one hand, someone would say to me, well, I thought you were an Iowa publisher. And I'd say, well, I guess what I really like are just interesting, unusual stories. So, I mean, and so I don't know. That's kind of how books come to be with me.
So, Caroline, some of the books that we've done, some of the interviews that we've done, if you recall, remember the White Man Who Stayed.
Oh, Jim Autry, yeah.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. That one I really liked. A Certain Arc, Essays of Finding My Way, David Hamilton. We did that one.
Right.
We did one of Mary Swander's years ago. That might have been one of the first ones we did of yours. And
I know you do Sal.
We did Sal Marisi. Three times, I think. Yep. He's a poet.
Well, he likes to talk, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. We had him on quite recently with Sneezing Coyotes, actually.
Mm-hmm. I think you may have done the, did you do Colleen Krantz on her, what did we call it? It was the immigrants found in the train cars in central Iowa.
I think you did that.
It was a while ago, but
yeah.
Right. Oh, Train to Nowhere. Yeah. That's it.
I think we did The Great Gamble with David Bluder. We did that one. We did.
You've done a lot of them.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you have.
We did Moon of the Snowblind. That was really interesting.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Oh, good. I don't think I ever knew that you talked to him.
Yes, we did. Fracture. Okay. We did Fracture.
Oh, yeah.
That was about fracking, basically.
Right. I hope that you're going to – well, I don't know. Are you going to do one with with Mary Christopher on the our friend Sitting Bull.
Yes,
I'm putting you in a bad spot on life.
Yeah, I have. I've read that. I'm giving it to Mom, and then we'll set it up. Yeah. I just got back. I went to warmer climes for a month. Just got back last night. Yeah, Schoolhouse. I think we did that one.
Yeah.
And Live Like Line, Love Like Ellen, Diamond Grove Slave Tree. That was
I can't remember. I do know his name.
Javier Cavazos. Right. Yeah, that one was really interesting. The Lost Clara Hughes of Paul Ingram.
All right.
Prairie Gold. Yes. Anthology. Yeah.
I mean, you're probably going to discover you've been doing them for almost 30 years.
Well, 15. We've been doing Writer's Voices for 15 years.
Oh, well, that works. Because I was thinking, because when I used to do, like, I used to have people read in Fairfield at, not 21st Century, but the Coffee Revelations.
Revelations.
And it's probably still there.
Yes, but it is.
I don't feel like it's as much of a bookstore. Maybe I'm just ignoring them. But
well, they're more of a cafe. But but they still have books.
They have events.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they still have events. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you see.
Yeah.
I'm going to figure that one out. Revelations.
And, of course, 21st Century Bookstore is no more.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
But that was, like, the first. Like, you can sort of it always feels like there's certain towns, no matter what, will have one bookstore. Even if one closes, and sort of all of a sudden you realize there's another one there. And Revelations seems to be able to continue then.
Yeah. Isn't there some other books? I mean, you mentioned, you know, Iowa City has the big Prairie Lights.
Right. I mean, we do have other ones.
There some haunted something?
Yeah, haunted bookstore.
Yeah.
I'm not discounting any of them. I just like, I mean, they're a used bookstore, and I have had one event there, and I mean, it's fine. It's always kind of a, like, exciting and unexciting to see any of the books I've done there. So I'm like, wait. It's there. Oh, wait, it's there.
Yeah, because it's used.
Why did someone get rid of it?
Yeah.
How dare they? But there's Iowa Book. There's Iowa Book. We don't call it Iowa Book anymore. It's called they're trying to get rid of books on everybody's names now.
Oh, wow.
It's a bad way to stay in business, to have a book in your store name. But there's kind of like Decorah always has a one bookstore. And Ames always has something, and Ella always seems to have something. And there's a good one in Indianola and Oskaloosa, Book Vault. And so they're still out there. I mean, reading is still like a thing to do. I mean, if people were asking me what's changed in the last couple of years, and people, like, at first everyone's like, everyone's going to be locked in their homes. They're going to be reading. I was like, not really. I didn't see like a huge uptick in book sales. There was more people buying directly from me. But the one thing I have noticed in the last year is apparently being in lockdown or socially distancing encourages a lot of people to write books. I've never had so many memoirs coming in. I mean, I probably get like 7 or 8 a week of just people like, oh, I finally had the chance to write such and such. And there's a talent to being able to do that, I'm afraid. I mean, there's a way of telling your life story and making it bigger than yourself and people learning from it versus just reciting what you did.
Yeah.
And hoping that somehow
someone will find it interesting. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So a lot of them, I think, are probably pretty well done. But you want to say, I'm sure that your family would love this. What you need to do is print 40 copies of this or something
now,
and share it that way.
Steve, do you ever get submissions that are maybe the story? It's an interesting topic, an interesting story, but the presentation really needs a lot of work, a lot of editing.
Oh yeah.
And do you ever take those on, or do you just say come back when it's a little more done?
I will say that recently I've had the good fortune of not having to. I wouldn't say better, but I think having been around longer, people that are are better known are sending me their books. And so I don't mean that they're necessarily better, So I'm able to kind of side, get around that a little bit, but I will say that the answer to your question, and it's not an extreme thing. Like, my example is I would much rather get an interesting, amazing story that needs help versus the most boring book ever that has zero grammatical errors. I mean, because I feel like if you have a good idea and you're really close to figuring it out, I can help with that and I want to help with that. But a boring topic told perfectly is still a boring topic. And so to answer your question, yes, that's kind of like me thinking I'm probably better than I am at something. But I mean, I think people mistake a perfectly told story as inherently being good enough to be published, but it's not an industry based on well-told stories. It's industry based on stories. And so I mean, in the end, if they're not worth it, so yeah. The answer to your question is yes. That I do that, but there's some lines in that, like, if it looks like it's going to take me a long time to figure it out, then no, I'd be like, you're so close, or try somebody else. But yes,
but you do work back and forth with your writers.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the first questions I ask people. Are you open to advice and editing and whatnot? Because some people aren't.
Right.
Which surprises me, but then again, not really. There's so many different kinds of people. Like, some people are sure they're right and they won't change it.
Yeah.
And so, and that's one of the things about being small like me, is I'll warn people that the biggest obstacle to being published by me is me. Because I have a bunch of stuff going on. I can only go so fast, and like, I don't have a huge marketing budget. And so a person that I work with has to understand the limitations of being working with someone that's, you know, I have a distributor, I have a salesperson that helps me some, and I hire people to help me with my website when I start to fall behind. And I have, sometimes I have interns and sometimes I don't. And I do have a few readers that will help me when I think a book is really, like your question, when it's got all the potential, it just needs help.
Yeah.
And then I'll say, okay, I'm sending you off to my nonfiction reader that I don't reveal their names ever, because the last thing they need is getting inundated. But and they'll just read it and they'll get back. And then it's sort of a three-way process at that point. We read books that way.
Caroline, do you have some more questions for Steve?
No, you pretty well covered it, dear.
So,
hey, you're supposed to ask me if you can get a book published sometimes.
Well, we'd have to write
it
first.
Well, I know that everybody has it. Yeah, everybody. Actually, Monica has written a book. I still have that book that you wrote, Monica. Mm.
Are you ready to submit it?
I need to go back over it.
And I'll reveal that Carolyn is one of my secret readers.
Ah.
I'll be like, now what you have to do is read your daughter's book closely. Hey, who's this person?
I'm not.
Hey, well, if everyone has a book or story to write, then I guess it means both of you have. Have you never written a book? Both of you?
Well,
Caroline
has written essays about her, some memoir essays.
Yeah, okay, so right. You've got your book inside you.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I do. I guess I do have my book, yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, you're one of those people, I'll say, like, when you ever finish your book, I'll publish it. And is that going to be a problem? Are you going to finish it soon? I mean, some people, you know, they tell you they have an idea, and you're like, yeah, send it to me when you're done.
Yeah.
It's like 99.9% of the time you never hear from me.
Yeah. I have a lot of book ideas, but I'm too busy.
Yeah.
Doing everything else. I mean, I'll start them sometimes. I actually was I have a book idea on which you would probably hate, but it's
no, I wouldn't. Haven't you learned? If there's anything you learn about me, it's like I have very few ideas I don't like.
On the morality of money.
That's be a good one. You haven't written that yet?
I haven't written that yet. I have 12 chapter headings, and that's it. Yeah. That's all I have. But
I was going to say that the easiest part of every book is the first 50 to 100 pages.
Yeah.
Have you ever you read there's this book I just picked up because I listened to Anna Sales' Death, Sex, and Money podcast.
Oh.
And she has the second chapter is the third chapter is money, and she talks about just people's inability to discuss money and how it's one of those three topics that everyone finds so hard.
Well, one of the things, you know, I have, in addition to Writer's Voices, I have several other businesses, and I've actually been very successful in life financially. Right. And so but I've also started out with basically nothing and have been very, have been fairly poor.
Right.
And so I really get to see, I feel like I have, and I'm an accountant by training. And so I have a really deep understanding of how money works. And I feel like I do have something I could say about it. Like one of my chapter headings is, why do the rich want to be richer?
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I know one time my dad said something like, one of his friends was like, I'm going to invest more money. And I remember he told me, he said to him, he's like, how much do you need?
Yeah. Like, how much is enough? I mean, how much is enough? Right. And why is it as you get to a certain level, it's no longer enough.
Right.
I think it would be interesting to really explore that.
See, but you thought I wouldn't like that.
Yeah, I did.
This is exactly how I love to find the fabulous. People will tell me something like that. I'm like, no, that sounds great. And that's how I was saying, like I picked books that would be interesting to me. Like, I would really like to find out more about that. Yeah. And so I tell you what, that's one of your assignments now. A year from now, we'll reverse roles. Me and your mom will interview you. I'll be perfect.
Well, Steve, we are out of time.
Okay.
And
I like this show.
This has been
these long shows.
Yeah, it's been
thanks.
It's been a joy.
And I probably said things that'll be held against me in a court of law, but I guess I'll just have to live with it now.
Caroline, do you have a closing quote for us today?
I do. Well, it's not a quote exactly, but it's a thought. You've heard it said, so many books, so little time. But isn't it wonderful that in this country, we have access to all these wonderful books?
Thanks to people like Steve Semkin of Ice Cube Press.
That's right. That's right.
Perfect. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Always fun.
See you all next week on Writer's Voices. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.